This thing is on display. It's on public display for 1,200 years. It is believed by most of people looking at it that it is magical, that it has powers.
Yeah.
Now, how much power does a human being have? Are we just meat or are we spirit? Is there mind over matter? Can the mind change matter? Can the mind have an effect on matter? If a million people looked at an object and thought it had magic, would that give it magic?
Seven daddy, seven coming out of the sky. Oh, won't you take me down to Memphis on a midnight ride? I won't move. Hey, you need a traveling pain. Yeah. Well, I'm flying across the land. Trying to get a hand. Hey, you need a traveling pain. Take me to the hotel. Bag it gone. Oh, well. Come on, come on. Won't you get me to my room? I won't move. Hey, you need a traveling pain. Yeah. Well, I'm flying across the land. Trying to get a hand. Hey, you need a traveling pain. Listen to the radio. Talking about the last show. Someone got excited. Had to call a state militia. Won't move. Hey, you need a traveling pain. Yeah. Well, I'm flying across the land. Trying to get a hand. Hey, you need a traveling pain. Wow!
Hello out there, my friends. This is Tim Benall of BenallOfAmerica.com with another edition of Benall of America Audio. It is March 11th, 2006. Our guest this week, Jerry E. Smith, part two of two. We're picking it up where we left off last week with Secrets of the Holy Lance. In part one of two, we discussed the Lance, where it came from, the history of the Lance, the legend of the Lance, and the various holders of the Lance leading up to where we start off today with Adolf Hitler. So go back and check part one of two for the Passion, Charlemagne, Constantine, Queen Boadicea, and all the various factions and folks that have held on to the spear up until it got into the grasp of one Adolf Hitler, which is where we start this week. And where we go this week is with Adolf Hitler. He has the spear, how he got the spear, what he did with it when he got it, Heinrich Himmler and his bizarre obsession with the spear, what happened to the spear post-World War II, the various rumors, is the spear in Austria the real spear, did the spear get sent to Antarctica, we talk about Nazi Antarctic bases, we talk about Admiral Byrd and Operation High Jump, we talk about rumors of Nazis escaping to Antarctica and Argentina, and we talk about the rumors of Adolf Hitler and whether or not he faked his own death. From there, we wrap up the discussion on Secrets of the Holy Lance with some existential questions, as you heard at the teaser at the beginning, sort of like what powers the spear, and irregardless of whether it was actually at the Passion. We discuss that sort of thing, some existential ponderings on the spear. And in the final half hour, we discuss Jerry's childhood friend, Jim Keith, who's very well known in the esoteric community. He passed away a few years ago. Jerry knew him from high school all the way up to his death, so this is a rare glimpse at the life and times of Jim Keith that is really priceless for anybody who's a student of esoterica and the various folks who've made serious contributions to the field. Here's a little bit about Jerry E. Smith for those of you who are unfamiliar with him. Check out part one of two for his in-depth bio that he gave us. He discusses where he came from and all that great stuff. So if you want to learn more about Jerry E. Smith, obviously check out part one of two for his bio that came straight from him. But here's a little bit about him. Jerry E. Smith has been a writer, editor, and activist for over three decades. In 1991, he and Jim Keith founded the National UFO Museum, NUFOM, in Reno, Nevada. From 1991 to 1994, Jerry was the executive director of NUFOM, while Jim Keith acted as the chairman of the board. In addition to his administrative duties of running the day-to-day operations of NUFOM, Jerry also edited and wrote for that organization's quarterly journal, Notes from the Hangar. At the same time, Jerry worked as an editor and graphic artist for Jim Keith's magazine, Dharma Combat, the magazine of spirituality, reality, and other conspiracies. Jerry served variously as managing editor and art director from Dharma Combat's inception in 1998 until Jim's untimely death in 1999. Today, Jerry lives and continues to write in Reno, Nevada. His websites are jerryesmith.com and secretsoftheholylance.com. And let me spell those out for you. It's jerryesmith.com and www.secretsoftheholylance.com, or you can just go to spearbook.com, spearbook.com, for all the information about Secrets of the Holy Lance. Without any further ado, let's rock and roll here. This interview was recorded on February 12th, 2006. Jerry E. Smith, Part 2 of 2, on Banal of America Audio.
Okay, so Hitler ascends to power in Germany and goes and takes the spear.
So
he sort of does what Napoleon wanted to do.
Exactly. He was the first non-royal to possess it in 1,200 years.
Which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And why don't you tell the story about how he gets it, because like the actual presentation to him of it, because it sounds like it was quite an, quite a big deal at the time.
Yeah, there are a number of conflicting stories as to what happened and when. Some say that he went straight to the spear. Others that it took him a couple days. What we believe happened was that the soldiers rolled into Austria, and while they did that, he sent some SS ahead to make certain that the spear was safe and that nothing wrong happened to it. He then went to his hometown of Lentz, where his mother had died, and went to his mother's grave and spent at least one day and two nights in Lentz before going on to Vienna. And there are two different stories about how he got the spear. One story says that he went directly to the spear, to the museum, and went into the museum and was alone with the spear for an hour. We don't think that's what happened. We have what we got was that there was a gala banquet held in his honor, a typical state banquet at the royal palace. And during the dinner, a certain Colonel Buch arrives with the spear in its velvet case and presents it. Apparently, the story goes that Colonel Buch and his SS men come in and line up against the wall, and everybody stops and looks at what the hell is going on here.
Yeah.
And clicks his heels. It must have sounded like a rifle shot going off in the banquet hall, and announces here is the Holy Lance. And Hitler gets up, comes to him, and Buch takes it out of the box and dubs him like a knight with it. At which point, supposedly Hitler kept it for an hour or so and then ordered it sent back to the museum. In the next few days, a special train, an armored train, took the entire Reich treasure back to Nuremberg. Now, what we gathered, what we've been able to piece together, is that he kept it for about 8 months.
Yeah.
And the whole Blitzkrieg period of the war, when he rolled into Poland and rolled into Belgium and rolled into France, that was the period where he had the spear.
Yeah.
And then it's an interesting as to what really happened to it at that point. We have to bring in Himmler.
Yeah.
If anything, Himmler was as freaked out about the spear as Hitler, if not more so. Before the war in 1935, Himmler had a replica of the spear made. He had found a castle called Wevelsburg, and he had redone the castle as a homage to the spear. Every room in the castle was appointed with stuff from the time of various, each room was dedicated to a particular possessor of the spear and was decorated with stuff that guy had had. So the Henry the Fowler room has got Henry the Fowler stuff in it. The Charlemagne room has got Charlemagne stuff in it.
So it's like a veritable Holy Lance museum.
Exactly. Himmler created... Himmler was a neo-pagan, a straight-ahead pagan. He was trying to bring back Sparta. He really wanted to bring back Sparta.
Yeah.
And you may recall, Sparta was a communist military dictatorship of homosexuals.
Huh.
Little odd place. And Himmler was an absolute believer in Aryan folk tales.
Mm-hmm.
Total believer in the whole Aryan race and the Teutonic Knights and the Holy Grail and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he created a circle of Holy Grail Spear of Destiny Knights called the Knights Grand Circle, and conducted weird black magic using his replica of the spear until the onslaught.
Yeah.
He brought the greatest swords maker from Japan to Wibelsburg and had them make an exact duplicate of the spear. And it's the duplicate that went on display at Nuremberg. And the real one stayed at his crazy castle to do bizarre black magic.
Now, Hitler was probably out of the loop on this switcheroo, correct?
Who knows?
You don't
know. Hitler seems to have surrendered the spear to back... He stopped using it.
Yeah. Now, do you think that ties into how Hitler sort of, it seems at some point in his reign of terror, Hitler sort of turned his back on his occult leanings. Do you think, did it occur around that time, you think?
It's hard to say. What we know about the occult in the Third Reich is not from original sources. You know, we know, basically, it's all hearsay, and it's hearsay compounded on hearsay on hearsay on hearsay.
Yeah.
Very little of those who were in the occult bureau of the SS survived, and very little of what they said survived. So there's an awful lot of, you know, very good research done on this. But what we can see is not what happened during the war, but what led up to the war.
Yeah.
And we can see there was the inner circle of the Nazi Party, about half were intense neo-pagan occult freaks, and the other half were militarists and futurists.
Yeah. So they didn't have, like, same shared interests type of thing.
No, it must have been a very strange place.
To have been
in the inner circle must have been really, truly, awesomely weird.
Yeah. And Hitler, so he has a spear for 8 months, and that's when he's going through Europe. He's cutting through, like, a swath.
Exactly. And again, you know, you use the spear in battle, you are invincible. And then he passes the spear to his pagan pope, who does weird stuff with it. Now, maybe the real spear really did go to Nuremberg and end up being recovered and going back to Vienna, or maybe it didn't. Again, Dr. Feather's work unearthed a spear that is a Carolingian spear. It's not a Roman spear. The folks who put forward the story that the spear did not go to Vienna say that the swordsmaker was instructed to use Carolingian technology, to use Carolingian materials intentionally, so that if they ever attempted to do testing of it, they would say that it was Charlemagne's hoax.
Yeah.
Now this is very interesting because this was said almost 20 years before the actual scientific testing was done. So it wasn't like they did the testing and they said, oh, well, see, that's because. This was, when they do the testing, they're going to find. And that's what they found.
Exactly.
I thought that was an interesting reversal of how it usually goes.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, it had been rumored for a long time that that might have been possible, and then in some ways the testing almost could have confirmed that idea, or gave credence to that rumor.
Right, and of course, this basically comes from a story which is probably a hoax. There was an American college professor who taught medicine, and he was a medical doctor. And during World War II, he had been a medic, and was one of the first people into Dachau prison. And there was a rather bit of nastiness at Dachau prison that most Americans are unaware of, called the Dachau Massacre. When the Americans liberated the Dachau prison, the first thing they did is they rounded up all the Germans, surrendered to them, and they put them in a spot. And then they went and looked around in the prison and discovered the horrible conditions there, and the U.S. soldiers freaked out. They went and shot every one of the Germans.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and this did not sit well with Dr. Buchner. And many years later, Buchner wrote a book about the Dachau massacre from an eyewitness standpoint. Shortly after his book was published, a person comes to him and says that he was a submariner with the German submarine fleet during World War II, and that he was part of the Führer convoy, the last three ships the last three or more submarines that took escaping Nazis, including Martin Bormann, from Germany as it was surrendering, and they had on board the Holy Lance, and they took the Holy Lance to Antarctica. And further, this sailor claims that he has proof that in 1979, the Holy Lance was rescued from Antarctica.
Exactly, which is where your book picks up, and at the beginning it ends it. And that is really one of the most fascinating parts of the book, because I have a long time interest in this, what is called Station 211, which would be the Nazi, the purported Nazi base at Antarctica.
Righto. So this sailor has the log of the Hartmann expedition and a signed handwritten letter of authenticity from Colonel Hartmann stating that this is true, and some photographs of some of the things that they found that they brought back from Antarctica. Now, the story goes that in 1945, as the Reich is falling apart, Hitler personally pulls aside Colonel Hartmann and tells him, I got some stuff I don't want anybody to get. You are in charge of making it go away and stay away. And Hitler gives materials, gives things to Hartmann, which includes things like his scout badges, personal memorabilia things, his favorite little painting and his favorite belt buckle, some odds and ends, crazy things.
Yeah, yeah.
And by the time Hartmann has acquired all this stuff and made it to the port of Kiel, Hitler is supposedly already dead in the bunker, and included with the stuff is the ashes of Eva and Hitler. And Colonel Buchmann wrote two books about this, Hitler's Ashes, Seeds of a Fourth Reich, and Adolf Hitler and the Secrets of the Holy Lance. These books are based on this guy. This sailor has come to him with the with the Hartman expedition, and says not only did Hartman take, not only did Hartman arrange to have these 8 bronze boxes of stuff put on a sub and the sub go to Antarctica and stash it, but in 1978, Rudolf Hess, who was in charge of building Station 211, and he stashed in 211. Hess, who's the last prisoner in Spandau Prison, is taken out of the prison for a couple of days for an ulcer. He's taken to a hospital, and while he's in the hospital, he manages to get a message out, and the message tells Hartman that he has to reconvene. He has to close the circle. He has to reconvene the circle of the Knights Grand Circle that Himmler had started. He has to bring back into existence the order of the Knights of the Holy Lance. And you can't do that unless you have the Holy Lance.
Yeah.
So he has to go down to Antarctica and get it.
Oh man.
So in 1979, he's now an aging businessman, and all the other knights are aging businessmen, and he pulls together an expedition and goes down to Antarctica in 1979, goes to where they stashed it, and it's beyond them to get all 8 boxes. They can only get 4 boxes. They bring 4 boxes back. And this sailor says that he was part of the Hartman expedition. He took the Lance to Antarctica in 1945, and he helped to recover it in 1979. And because Buchner has written this book about the Dachau massacre, it shows that he's a good man, and that he can be trusted by the German people with this knowledge. So he then gives him, the log to the Hartman expedition and these photographs and yada yada, which he and Buchner write the first book, Hitler's Ashes, but the sailor dies while they're writing the book. Buchner did quite a bit of research to try and establish whether or not this was a total hoax or the truth, and he contacted most of the people who claimed to be part of the Hartman expedition. He contacted a number of people who were part of the Führer convoy that was at least 3 subs, and there was a lot of corroborating evidence. I mean, the 2 of the 3 subs surrendered months after the war's end. The war ended in June, Nazi Germany surrendered in June, and one of the subs surrenders in July, and another one in August. Both at Mar del Plata, the closest Argentine naval base to Antarctica.
Yeah.
And their stories, the stories of the captains of where they've been and why it took them a couple of months to get around to surrendering don't make any sense. They don't hold water. Both the captains are held by the U.S. and the Brits for a year and a half, and the eventually the Brits let them go because they figure that they can't get any more out of them. When the ships surrendered, there were some very odd things. Now these are the super submarines. They're the size of aircraft carriers.
Oh wow!
They were not made as war machines. They were made as they're underwater cargo ships.
Yeah.
They were made initially to supply the submarine fleet. By building these underwater cargo ships, they could get stuff out of the Baltic Sea where they were being built to the Atlantic Ocean and resupply the U-boats.
Mm-hmm.
At war's end, they changed their mission and they became part of the Northern Rat Line, which was how the Nazis escaped. The Southern Rat Line was through the Vatican and Spain, and the Northern Rat Line was through Norway and the subs. It's pretty clear that Martin Bormann was on one of those ships. Oddly enough, Bormann, one of the ships that surrenders, is packed with cigarettes and brandy. And submariners don't smoke or drink on duty. And it was Martin Bormann's brand of cigarettes and brandy. The other ship had 76,000 pairs of shoelaces.
Oh, wow. That's strange.
Yeah. So Buchner concluded that it was a true story, that there really had been an effort to hide in Antarctica Hitler's special things. Now, what we do in the book Secrets of the Holy Lands is we kind of springboard off of that.
Yeah.
Because there are all these urban legends about Station 211 and New Schwabenland and the Nazi attempt to put a colony in Antarctica. And so we build on the Buchner scenario by giving all that we know about it, which is quite a bit, oddly enough.
Yeah, you guys have a lot of information in the book about that, about the Nazi base at Antarctica. Tell me a little bit about that. How did that come about, do you think, and how extensive do you think it really was, and how do you think it really turned out to be? That's where a lot of Nazis went after the war, and is it still there, you think, or tell me about that.
Well, what we know is that in 1938, there was a German Antarctic expedition that claimed about a fifth of the continent as a German colony, as German property.
Yeah.
They took something like 11,000 photographs. They dropped hundreds of Nazi flags and rods with a metal top with the logo of the expedition, and claiming a statement that they were claiming it for their country.
Yes.
So we know that the Nazis did in fact claim a big piece of Antarctica as German territory. There have been literally from day one, literally from 1940 on, stories of an attempt for the Nazis to actually occupy their territory. And most of the stories say that the effort was called Station 211, or codename Station 211.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost impossible to get any hard facts on this, one way or the other. The rumors, particularly the internet rumors, particularly the Russian press, is just wacky stuff. You remember during the Cold War days that the great Russian newspaper was Pravda.
Exactly, yeah.
Right? Pravda is Russian for truth. Apparently, Pravda has become like the National Enquirer of Russia these days.
Sure seems it, yeah.
And they have been running wild stories about not only, the Germans called it New Schwabenland, where at the same time, literally like 3 days later, or 3 days earlier, the Norwegians had claimed the same property, calling it Groning or Queen Maud Land. Now, the Soviets, Pravda is claiming that the capital of New Schwabenland is called New Berlin, and that there are between 2 and 3 million inhabitants there right now.
Wow.
And not only that, but then it has the city. It goes stretches for hundreds of miles through tunnels, through the ice and the mountains, and they have many. We have found something like 170 lakes under the ice now. And so there is this claim that these lakes are not just under the ice, they're like resorts. and the New Berlin has an alien quarter where peoples from other worlds hang out.
Yeah, and it sort of ties into the whole, I don't want to say hollow earth, but like underground earth tunnel aspect of the esoteric research, which is
right. That was another aspect of the book, is that Himmler wasn't just crazy for the Holy Lands. He was crazy for all of, you know, he really was trying to find the Ark of the Covenant. The Indiana Jones stories are based in fact. I mean, they really were looking for it.
Yeah.
And they were also looking for Atlantis and Shambhala or Shambhala.
Yeah.
They were trying to find the entrance into the Hollow Earth. There probably is no such thing, but it's a piece of human consciousness that keeps popping up, you know, that people keep telling stories about it. And there are so many weird connections to all this. The one is the Admiral Byrd connection. Byrd had been invited to join the 1938 German expedition, and for unknown reasons decided not to. And then in 1946-47, he leads the largest expedition ever mounted to Antarctica. And this was no scientific expedition. It was purely military. It was a U.S. Navy show run by the U.S. Navy, and it was their first Antarctic mission in 100 years since Wilkes had explored the place. And this expedition is 4,700 men, an aircraft carrier, two destroyers, a submarine, several dozen aircraft, both fixed wing and rotary. This was a major military expedition.
And this is, that's Operation High Jump, right?
That's Operation High Jump.
Yeah, and that's very well known in some circles in esoterica. I definitely, if you want to know more about Operation High Jump, check out this book, because this book gave a lot of great information, because I've always been looking for more, and you guys just provided a ton of stuff.
Yeah. That was a fun piece of research. I wrote the Antarctica stuff, and I wrote the ancient history stuff. And George wrote the crucifixion and the immediate aftermath of the crucifixion, Joseph Arimathea and Queen Boadicea, and he wrote all the Nazi stuff.
Nice.
So I spent all my time researching either Roman politics or Station 211.
Nice. And so Operation High Jump, it kind of never really got off the ground once they got to Antarctica, and the rumors are that they actually engaged in battle with Nazis. Obviously, that's not what came out in the press reports and the mainstream historical accounts, but there's always been that tinge to it that perhaps that what really was going on was some kind of battle between Nazis and the U.S. expedition there, which is what Operation High Jump was.
Exactly. High Jump was outfitted with all this stuff, and they had enough provisions to be there for 8 months. Now, the Antarctic summer is a little over 3 months long. The good weather, they could maybe have squeezed 6 months out of it. They were actually there for, I think it was 16 weeks.
Yeah.
And they left abruptly. I mean, one day, Byrd just said, "Okay, we're pulling the plug. We're leaving in an hour. Everybody, pack your bags." You know, it was like what? And there was never any explanation for it. It was just a sudden, "Okay, we're going now." It's still to this day, nobody has a clue why.
Yeah, it's very mysterious. And Byrd has a sort of weird tie-in to Antarctica altogether. Not only what you said about how he was invited to the original Nazi or German expedition to Antarctica, but then later on, was this after High Jump that he had the diary and the recording flight into the middle of Earth and all that crazy stuff?
Okay, it is literally crazy stuff. What it is Byrd had a son, and sometime, I think in the 1960s, Byrd's son started came up with this diary of his father in which it was claimed that Byrd had flown 600 miles into the Hollow Earth and met the king of the Hollow Earth and had dinner with him,
yeah,
long conversations and yada yada. Well, Byrd's son was stone crazy,
yeah,
and just made this thing up. But it's gotten a lot of circulation. You know, a lot of people think it's real.
But there's no real credence to the Byrd diary.
Have you read it? You can actually get it on the internet. You can actually read the whole darn thing on the internet, and it is just it's really bad science fiction.
Yeah, I've read pieces of it.
Yeah.
Do you think maybe that was, just to throw this out there, sort of like a theory, maybe that the diary was sort of like a cloaked story, that there was something to investigate at the Antarctica, but it wasn't, you know, but they had to cloak it almost in such bizarre terms.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised. You take the military are very well known for disinformation programs in which they will take a truth and to hide the truth, they will add layers of nonsense on top of it, and people will stop looking at the truth. The classic is Paul Benowitz in the Dulce Base stories.
Yeah.
There was an advanced aircraft program that he was seeing, and they got him to look the other way by feeding him all this Dulce Base nonsense.
Now, obviously, since 79, that's obviously technology's advanced and expeditions probably have advanced. Has there been any sort of sightings of Station 211 or any, like, more recent, other than the Providence stuff, anything coming out from the science community or esoteric science community that has any more information on Station 211 that might shed light on it, like, you know, a hash somewhere or, like, a cool picture?
I hate to say this, but no. But I think I've figured out why. And that is the probable site seems to be in the Hoffman-Mulig mountain range.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an ice-free area. Most people don't realize that 2% of Antarctica is ice-free. There's lots of geothermal in that area. There is life there. It's quite possible. I mean, people live in Antarctica now. There are full-time residents in Antarctica.
Yeah.
Mostly at McMurdo Station and at the South Pole Station. But there are people who live there year-round. I'm actually thinking about joining them.
Yeah.
I'd like to open a bar in McMurdo. I understand there are 3 bars in McMurdo now. If there are 3, there's probably room for a 4th.
Yeah.
McMurdo now has over 1,000 buildings. It's a big place.
Yeah.
The winter population is around 4,000. The summer population is about 15,000 to 20,000 scientists, and between 20,000 and 40,000 tourists.
Oh wow!
Yeah, and tourism is booming there. The tourism is so big, the Argentines are building a Las Vegas-style resort on an Antarctic island.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
And how far away is that from where Station 211 would be?
Well, on the opposite side of the continent.
Oh, wow.
The dead opposite side of the continent. The area in the Mulig Hoffman mountain range that could be where 211 is, this area is now is now sequestered. It is a protected zone. The Antarctic Conservation Act of 1978, a U.S. government law, has created that area as a specially protected zone because it is a breeding site. It's a nesting grounds for a couple of different kinds of birds.
Huh.
And it's now no humans allowed location.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if Station 211 really is somewhere in Antarctica, this would be the best way to keep the world from finding out about it.
Exactly. Now, did the Hartmann expedition, did they go there before or after it was protected? It was called protected.
They went there after. It was protected in 78, and they went there in 79.
Oh, okay. All right.
And there was a Norwegian base at the protected site. Called Station Tor, T-O-R.
Yeah.
Tor is It may be just to watch the birds breed, or it may be to map mine and figure out what they can find in 211.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, can you let's say I was super rich, can I fly over Station 211, or would they be like, would they shoot me onto or shoot me down or something?
I'm not real sure. There is a moratorium on tourist air flights.
Yeah.
A tourist plane in about 5 or 8 years ago crashed into Mount Erebus, which is the only active volcano in Antarctica. It's a few miles from McMurdo, and this tourist plane was trying to land at McMurdo, and it crashed into Mount Erebus, and they banned tourist flights. So I don't know if I don't think there's any civilian flying taking place in Antarctica right now.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I'm not super rich anyway, so that won't be a problem for me.
Yeah, but there was a U.S. Navy event recently that was reported to the world as one thing, and it may have been something else. The U.S. Navy may have been searching for 211 couple of years back. What it was is during Operation High Jump, there was one admitted air disaster in which one of the flying boats, one of the PBYs, crashed and burned, and half the crew were killed. I think it was like four guys were killed, and they never recovered their bodies. So I think it was 2003 that the U.S. Navy went looking for the crash site and didn't find it. But did they go looking for the crash site, or were they really looking for 211 and use the crash as an excuse?
Exactly, yeah. And one of the other aspects of the book that you get into pretty heavily, like you said, you've done your own research into it, was the shadowy circumstances of Hitler's death. We're kind of bringing it back here now to the end of World War II, and how mysterious Hitler's death was. Nowadays, it's sort of accepted as fact that he killed himself in the bunker, but back then, it was actually pretty controversial at the time. It was kind of like how Bin Laden is now, whether, like, is he alive or not. At least back then, it was sort of like they claimed he committed suicide, but there was never really any proof about it, and there never really has been. Correct.
Right. You actually hit on one of my favorite pieces in the book, because George first drafted that, and then I went crazy and added a great deal on that. And in the process of researching it, I found the Hitler's home address in Argentina, and went, "Wow, this is so good!"
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So in 2004, an Argentine published a book that is a tour guide to where the Hitlers lived, and he grew up in the town, and so he knows all these. It was a town that had a bunch of Nazis, and most of them came via submarine. They came in the Fuhrer convoy.
Yeah.
And so he grew up with these guys.
Oh, man.
And so he wrote a book exposing where they lived, and it's got, you know, like diagrams and maps and everything, so you can actually go and check out the Hitler's house.
Oh, wow.
Needless to say, we don't believe that he died in the bunker. Then there's the evidence of him dying in the bunker is all hearsay. It's all secondhand. When Berlin fell, the Soviets took it over, and they did not allow the Allies, the British or the Americans, in for 8 weeks. And by the time my 8 weeks were up, the evidence in the bunker was completely muddled. You know, there was no way you could do any sort of forensic study from that. There was a U.S. You may remember during the Gulf Wars, we had a guy who always knew where Saddam Hussein was, right? Because they're trying to shoot him, which a lot of people thought was playing dirty, but we had a whole branch of intelligence
tracking where is Saddam this minute. Well, during World War II, we did that also. We had a full bird colonel with a department tracking where is Hitler right now, and he was one of the first people in the bunker. And he said that what the Soviets said was bunk. the evidence that the Soviets presented was one of Hitler's hats and one of Ava's panties. And these things had scorches on them, and supposedly this is what's left from them burning him. Later, the Soviets dragged out an autopsy that was clearly false, because the autopsy was of a man with one testicle. Now, the whole bit about Hitler having one testicle was an urban legend.
Yeah.
He was a normal man, at least physically.
Yeah.
And so the Soviet autopsy is clearly nonsense. I pulled together a number of really good quotes, including one from the U.S. Secretary of State, who was at a conference with Stalin after the war, and he reported that, this is the Secretary of State in his tell-all biography or autobiography. He says that at this dinner party, at one point, Stalin gets up and comes over to him and clinks glasses with him, and he decides to ask, and he asks Stalin, "Do you think Hitler died in the bunker?" And Stalin says, "No, he escaped. He went either to Spain or Argentina."
Yeah, that's pretty powerful stuff. And that sort of speaks to the idea that a lot of the top level Nazis probably escaped. And at the time, I guess Germany was just completely decimated, and Japan obviously was destroyed. So it was probably in the best interests of everybody at the time, I guess, to say, to just go with the story, right?
Right. At the time, most of America did not believe that he died in the bunker. Opinion polls taken throughout the 50s were the majority of Americans, like 75 to 85%, thought Hitler had escaped. And there were Hitler sightings, like Elvis sightings, that went on for decades. Some of the Hitler sightings were hilarious, and some of them were, wow, that might actually have been him.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty fascinating. And the book is awesome for that stuff, too, especially just tons of in-depth material on the potential of a Hitler escape, which has really been fascinating.